All right, welcome back. Nice to see all of you. All right, so today we're going to continue to explore emotions as a daily life practice and how we open that into a rich part of exploration of the Dharma. So last talk, in 2 weeks ago, we talked about how to work with emotions when they're very gripping, when they have that sense of sweeping us off our feet, and how to find a place to ground ourselves, to find a sense of spaciousness around those emotions, a sense of stability that allows us to release the story, and then to turn toward the more tender aspects of that emotion and how that starts to allow us to quiet down, to actually meet that instead of being gripped by it. And tonight, we're going to start to use that as a basis, and it may be just a small version of that. Sometimes we can just open to an emotion right away. But to use emotion as a gateway into investigation, and particularly to see how emotions are really intricately connected to creating this sense of self, this sense of I, this unconscious, unquestioned belief in a sense of I, of me, of mine. So this way it becomes this gateway into investigation. And so we have to have a awareness and sensitivity to our emotional lives, because that starts to reveal some of the deeper levels of identification, the deeper levels of dukkha that arise, the deeper ways we create suffering in ourselves, and the release of that suffering, the release of that dukkha, the unbinding of our heart. So tonight I want to explore emotions in kind of two basic modes in relationship to this. The first one is the emotions which are not connected to that, not anchored really in that sense of self. Emotions that we just allow flow through us. It's like they become bigger than anything we can, you know, personalize. It's just we allow it to flow. So it might be something intense like grief or loss that we just is too big to personalize, or it could be just simply relating to something like joy or even irritation or anger in a way that just flows through us without it being caught in that sense of self, not feeding back into that sense of me, not maintaining or generating that sense of self. So this often has a wordless quality to it. And it's not about clinging. It's not about creating that sense of me, as those of you who went through this last year's approach to the dependent origination. The other mode is when emotions do self-reference, when they define who we are in that moment, maybe in our whole life or in this stage of our lives. This is mine. This is me. I'm having this emotion. You've caused that emotion in me. This is you. This is yours. This is really the central point of tonight's talk and exploration. Is emotions which reinforce that sense of self, and then emotions which are free from the sense of self. And to start to use that as a gateway into working with emotions dharmically. So let's first explore those emotions which define us, that create that sense of me, in different, you know, very subtle ways and also very strong ways. This is really a shift in how we've approached it since the last week's talk. So we need to recognize that emotions can be really an expression of self, an expression of that. And when I say self, I mean that from the Buddhist perspective. That sense, not the, so much the psychological self, but much more the Buddhist sense of self, of isolation, of separation. And I can relate to an emotion in a way that leads to more selfing, more of a sense of me. Now, selfing, that selfing, is the same, it's basically the second noble truth, the cause and origination of dukkha, of suffering. And I think we all know this. You know, we feel charged, we feel triggered, we feel upset, and we just start to churn around and say, oh, I feel so upset about that. I want to do something about that. I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to email. I'm going to text. Or we just kind of have this dialogue with ourselves or imagine with the other person. This is very common. This is so much of how we do this. And we can reframe that whole process as selfing. Instead of being lost in it unconsciously and just engaging in it, to step back and say, oh, this is selfing. This is the second noble truth. This is dependent origination in action. This is a felt sense of that experience. And then, of course, we can relate to the same emotion in a way that doesn't lead back to that sense of self. It actually leads to stillness and to a sense of flow of emptiness as it just flows through us. So again, talking about how emotions can drive selfing. Now, emotions are really often this expression of clinging. So clinging, I'm using that technically from the dependent origination, that you have contact with the sense data, you have that sense of it being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and that leads to the quality of craving, to clinging, to becoming, to birth. Okay, that's this whole process. When you're caught in an emotion, when that's really active in you, you're living those, that what the Buddha discovered some 2,600 years ago. There's a famous quote by Dogen, the patron saint of Zen, that I often like to read, that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. And this is a very profound utterance by Dogen. But to study the self, to study the Buddha way, to study the Dharma is to study the self, is to understand that. So that's what this first section of this exploration tonight is around, is seeing that when an emotion arises, it's an opportunity to study the self. To see, well, where is this? How is this self manifesting? How is it forming? Because it's such a unconscious assumption that we just pick up. It's like, yeah, I'm angry. I'm feeling this. I'm angry, I'm mad, I'm afraid, I'm happy. So we all know this, that emotions define us, shape us. They create the sense of who we are in that moment. The shape of who the other person is really shaped, influenced, formed by that emotion. And actually, usually we think that I'm the one who's having the emotion. In reality, the emotion's really having us. The emotion is having us, it's creating us. It's this manifestation of again, craving to clinging to becoming, to birth. That's the experience of having an emotion. We have that sense of me has to pop up in relationship to that emotion. Now, this exploration is by no means discounts or ignores the fact that most of us, need to work on our emotional lives, learning how to have a healthy self, sense of self, a self-esteem, a sense of integrity, a sense of feeling okay with ourselves, and how that leads into having healthy relationships. Some of the things we'll explore later in this year as we explore, continue. And at the same time, Dharma work is not ignoring that reality, not ignoring that the necessity of being having a healthy sense of self, but then goes deeper to understand what is the nature of that self? What is it created from? And emotions are this gateway into understanding that. Another way to look at this is that we can say that one of the big benefits of emotions is that it helps to establish a sense of self. Emotions help to establish a sense of me. And you can use, of course, emotions. I'm peeling that out because that's the topic. But we could use any sense, anything that we create a sense of separation between us and the world. Anytime we do that, that is the big benefit is it creates the sense of self. It creates a sense of separation, of isolation. And that actually does have a huge benefit. And that's why it's not so easily seen through. It's not so easily released. as Dogen said, to release that, there is that returning to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. And when you're actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. That dropping away is a little disconcerting until we see the depth of peace of that. And so we form ourselves back in. We keep putting ourselves back together. If we don't recognize this mechanism, we're tying ourselves really to that unconscious self. We're tying ourselves into the Four Noble Truths, and the truth of suffering and the truth of dukkha. So that's kind of the edge that we come as Dharma practitioners, is how fully do you want to really practice? How deeply you want to practice? And it's, you know, it's an individual choice to see what is right for us. You know, it could be that it's much more important right now in your practice to establish that healthy sense of self, to have that sense of ease, that sense of safety, that sense of belonging. So how do we practice with these emotions that drive into this sense of self, that have that mechanism of selfing? Now, it's been said that the human birth, taking birth in a human form, is the ideal because it has the right mixture of suffering and ease. The right mixture of suffering and ease. It has enough suffering that it keeps us like, okay, this isn't working. I need to find some way to release that, to get through that. And yet there's enough ease, enough comfort, enough joy, enough love, and all of those things that we're able to not be overwhelmed by the suffering. So we have enough suffering to motivate us, but not so much that we're overwhelmed. We have enough of the good stuff to help us balance. And some rebirths that are much, much more painful, much more difficult, there's not enough space to actually practice. In other births, there's too much joy, too much ease, too much pleasure, really. So you don't have the motivation to practice. So not to get into Buddhist cosmology, but we can know this for ourselves, that people who, when it's going really well and really easily, we don't have as much motivation to practice, perhaps. But when life is difficult, but not too difficult, we have the motivation to practice. And maybe when life is so difficult, we lose that motivation to practice. So we can look at these, the sense of birthing into this human realm, as these different conditions of our lives. So one of the secrets of Dharma practice in daily life is to use this very human element, this all its ugly truths, its painful parts, all of the parts that we judge, as a spiritual practice. Actually learn to turn it on its head, not as something that's an obstacle, but actually as a gift. Because, you know, believe it or not, those areas that we most struggle with actually clearly show how we create the sense of me, the very personal way, the unique way that we create that sense of self, the sense of me in relationship to the world. So in this way, emotions can be a key aspect of practice. It can actually be a cue, like a reminder to be present. You know, often when we go on retreat or we take a beginning class, we have this, we really love how mindfulness feels. And we realize, okay, I'm on a retreat. I don't have anything to do but be mindful. I mean, mindful why I walk, why I sit, why I eat my food, why I go to the bathroom. We start to feel that mindfulness just permeate all our experience, everything that we do. We come back into life and say, I want to keep doing that. I want to be mindful every moment. And then, you know, someone honks their horn at us, or we have to get our kids ready for school and we have 4 or 5 minutes late, or whatever happens, we just get too busy. We can use emotions actually as the reminder bell, a bell that reminds us, oh, this is actually a chance for practice. This is a chance to pay more attention. This is where investigation and mindfulness can emerge together. And so it's helpful to have that sensitivity to emotions. And what I mean by that, it's just like attuning a radar dish or a radio channel to hear the subtle manifestation of emotion. Like just a general kind of contraction of the heart or the tightening of the stomach. Sometimes I think we look for those big expressions of emotion, the big fireworks, and we miss the much more subtle ways that emotion are just constantly coming and going. The slight bit of fear, the slight bit of joy, the apprehension, the anger, the irritation. You start to attune to those subtle qualities. That's a much easier way to practice, much more attainable. So this is really the first noble truth, is turning into that quality of dukkha. So as I spoke about 2 weeks ago, yeah, kind of the first aid or the remedies when we get overwhelmed by emotion, to find that ground, finding our connection with the earth, having a sense of spaciousness to some degree, releasing the story around the emotion, and then learning to, where is that most tender aspect of that emotion, and attending to that, caring for that. So now, this night, we start to refocus that whole process on this selfing mechanism, this mechanism of creating this sense of self, the sense of me. So you notice that when you have an emotion, when it's kind of moving through you and it has some momentum and there's some storyline, the details of your life, and you think, okay, this is what it means about me, about the other person. You basically create yourself a role for you as an actor in a play. And you start to form that and what you're going to say and what happened and what might happen. This is a felt sense of how the self is being created. I mean, you're literally saying, this is me having this experience. This is me wanting this, not wanting this. And so we learn to turn toward that. We use that cue of emotional friction to turn toward and say, ah, there's a sense of me arising. One of the homeworks for this week, one aspect is to notice when you get in an emotional cycle, you know, just feeling that. Notice, recognize that, reframe that as, oh, this is me selfing myself. This is me creating a story. And not only the story, but it's creating this background placeholder that we call I, that we call me. Not trying to change it, not trying to fix it or get rid of it, but just to notice that. And as I was doing that homework today, you know, when that happened, emotions happen, and I find myself kind of going down the self-narrative and what I'm going to say, and da-da-da-da, and it's like, oh, this is selfing happening. I'm creating that sense of me. And just that stepping back, just that sense of recognizing what is happening there, shifted that in a profound way. You know, to study the self is to forget the self. So we turn toward it, and we try to find, where is that self located? And that self is not as clear as it is when we're not paying attention to it. When it's held back in that unconscious realm, it has a lot of strength, a lot of momentum. Now, to help with this, some of the big key in working with emotions is to drop our outward projection. Okay? The projection outward of who's causing this emotion, who's making me feel this way, what situation it is. Because if we keep that to the forefront, we're really reinforcing and engaged in this whole process. That what the other person said or did or the situation, yes, it may need to be attended to, may need to be attended to skillfully. But this really isn't a life skills course. It's not a life skills process. It's really learning that freedom in the midst of experience. So setting aside for the moment what needs to be done. And instead saying, okay, I'm having this emotion. I'm taking full ownership of it. If you don't do that, we'll still stay caught in that. And that may be, we usually have to practice that for a while until we realize, oh, that just leads to more suffering, leads to that cycle self-perpetuating. It just keeps that sense of self rolling right along. But owning that, okay, this is me having this emotion. It's not setting aside whatever the other person may have done. To feel it fully is a key step. Another aspect that I think is really helpful, and this is what I use for myself, and also if I'm working with the Dharma student, is to listen for where the sticky spot is. Where are things caught? Where's the identification, the rub? What part is not being allowed? What part is being judged? You know, what part is just, okay, that's not acceptable. You know, we all know that. We all have those parts. And then turning our heart to that. Letting our hearts work to embracing even that part that is sticky. Often think of it as if we had a silk sheet and we're sliding it over another silk sheet, it would just smooth effortlessly. Okay, so that's kind of the baseline of when our awareness is not self-reference, it's not identified, there's that silk sliding on silk. There's no friction. But then let's say we put a rock or a stone or a whatever it is in the midst of that, underneath those two sheets, it becomes this place where the silk snags. You slide it and it snags. And that's a way of describing when our awareness snags on a place of identification. This is the sticky point. This is the part that's stuck. This is where the charge is. So this could be a belief, could be an assumption, an overlay. Maybe spiritual people don't get angry. Spiritual people don't hold resentment. These are all overlays that we impose. Those become those sticky points that silk sheet gets locked upon, gets stuck upon. Now, what is actually present? What's actually here? You know, do we completely 100% allow it to be just how it is? Not 95% or 99% even, but 100%. If there's not that 100% acceptance of allowing it to be just how it is in this moment, again, we're setting aside the actions of what needs to be done, but just this way, how liberation is found in this very moment. Okay, I'm filled with anger, I'm filled with rage, I'm filled with fear. If there's no friction, if that silk slides over that, then it's not self-generating. It's not generating that sense of self. This is tricky. This is a difficult process because we all have our justifications. Like, well, that works for a lot of stuff, but not for this issue, not for this belief. I'm really right now, and that person, in this case, is really, really wrong. And we just hold on to that. Oh, dear. Sorry, the wind blew my talk away. Not too far away, though. So, again, it's not talking about actions right now. It's talking about that relationship, you know, and how we justify. And the tricky thing, I mean, that is really a simple part. It's not tricky at all. Is all we have to do is see what's held outside the heart. What are we holding outside the heart in this moment? And then we just bring that back into the heart in some way. Learn to even love that aspect. And so to do that, we often have to see those particular ways that we grip, that we have those assumptions, you know, seeing those, opening to those, you know, feeling that shape. This is really starting to see this unconscious foundation of self, the way we create that sense of me. And so we have to be completely honest with ourselves. And this is one of the, I think we maybe all have known that we kind of self-deceive ourselves a little bit. And we finally acknowledge that self-deception, really acknowledge that, yeah, actually I am feeling that. I am having that experience. Something softens. There's a sense of loosening. That loosening is a softening of that sense of me. So fully accepting, when we get triggered, not to overlook or ignore or judge ourselves. Even if we've been practicing for so many years and we think we should be over this, it's here. Let's meet it. Let's open to it. Start to see that this is a beautiful chance to start to understand the sense of self, the sense of me. So this was all about emotions and how they generate that sense of self. They have that self-generate me that kind of drive that whole process and how to work with that. The other way, the other mode I talked about at the very beginning, was when emotions arise, but they're not anchored in self. They're not self-referencing. They're not stuck back, focusing back on who I am, what I am. And this is that deeper issue I alluded to earlier on, is that, as Dzogchen talked about, when we really do this, the forms and bodies of ourselves and others fall away. And when we release any friction with our emotion, with our belief, whatever is here, we become less form. Because that friction is actually what forms us. That friction is a significant part of that mechanism that creates that sense of me. Being less formed is a little scary. It's a little disorienting. And that's where that question, you know, the question is, like, how much freedom do we really want? So often we go into the relativeness, like, okay, I need to have these relative freedoms, these relative truths. Okay, the question is, do we want absolute freedom? If we want absolute freedom, or do we want relative freedom? Relative freedom depends on conditions, depends on things looking a certain way, the absence or presence of things. While absolute freedom doesn't depend on conditions. Now, the poem I read at the end of the sit, So Much Happiness, I'm going to read that one again right now in this part of this evening. And as you listen to that, notice how Naomi Shihab Nye really captured this sense of emotions not being contained by this sense of me. How there is two, they flow through you, right, versus that contraction of identification. So much happiness. It is difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there is something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You're happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches. And love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens, the scratched records. Since there's no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands, and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You're not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. She captured this sense of emotions which are not self-referencing. There's no place large enough to contain so much happiness. It flows out of you into everything that you touch. So this is the thing about emotions, is that when we learn to free them from that sense of self, they actually start to flow through us in a beautiful way. We see them. Even something like sadness, even something like fear or anger, certainly happiness, we see it can't be contained by that sense of self. It's much just flowing through us. Another poem that I've often read by Naomi Shihab Nye, the kindness poem, also points to this. And sometimes in our lives, when we have that intense sorrow, when we feel sadness and grief to such a depth, something opens up in a way that releases that contraction of me. And she speaks to this too, as kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be. Between the regions of kindness. how you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too is someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for. And then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. That line that you must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows. And you see the size of the cloth. And then it's only kindness that makes sense anymore. That's that movement from the contracted self-making relationship to emotion that's just flowing through you. It's too big to contain. You see, you allow it to open to such a degree. This is what I was trying to point to 2 weeks ago when we take an emotion and open it up, open the container. It's a way of teaching this aspect of releasing that personalization around it. So emotions flow through. So how do we practice with emotions, which that self, not the non-self referencing? So going back to Dogen, that when you forget the self, to be actualized by myriad, you become actualized by myriad things. When you're actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of all of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. And these words were spoken from a very realized, enlightened place. And so we have to start to develop this taste for the formless. Developing a taste for that's outside of our normal contraction of mind, that contraction which is created by me observing something else. And once we start to have a taste of that, start to realize that and develop this, our hearts start to actually yearn for it, then we start to orient toward that. We start to see, where is that formless right here? And then when emotions arise, which are not anchored in the sense of self, and they're flowing through us, as Naomi spoke about happiness and around sorrow, then we just surrender and relax into those. We relax into them, allow them to flow, and allow ourselves to merge with the stillness. You can see in this way that emotions sometimes contract around the sense of me and generate the sense of me, but they can also be held in this way that just is actually not being held at all. They're flowing through us. So from a Dharma perspective, all we have to do is track or orient toward this. Is this emotion leading to something, leading to a sense of self, or leading to emptiness? Just a simple noticing, not judging, not trying to fix it or go one way or the other, but just simply noticing it. This is the Dogen and saying, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. Study that contraction. Study how that forms. And what does it look like? And that self, emotions that lead to that selfing, which lead to that sense of self, a perspective of isolation. We feel more defined. We feel more oriented. Okay, I am this. You are that. It can be very painful, but that painfulness still clarifies, okay, this is who I am in this moment. While emotions which lead to emptiness have this undefined quality. It becomes something we can't point toward with any words or any sense of concept. It's much bigger than that. And so how are we relating to this emotion? This is the live question, the invitation for this practice. Are we relating to it in a way that reinforces the sense of me, perpetuate the sense of selfing, or does it lead to dissolving of that self? All right, I think that's enough words around this right now. So let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle where they will. Even as I sit right now, I can feel the subtle flavor or emotion, something it's hard to categorize, but a quality of warmth, tingling, pressure in the chest. And if I don't self-reference around it, it's simply another experience. It simply flows. It actually leads to this deeper sense of stillness. So this week, as we practice around emotions, start to highlight that as you go through your day, as you walk through your life. When emotions arise, pause with that. Notice, okay, here's an emotion arising. Let me practice a little bit with that. Try to reframe that normal self-narrative, that self-talk, you know, all the chatter that goes on. Reframe it as selfing, as establishing and maintaining the sense of self. Start to actually get a sense of that. It's like, oh, yeah. Relating to this argument with my loved one, my spouse, with my boss, with my employee, that helps define who I am. In that moment, I really am clear. I'm having this emotion. I am upset. Again, there's a healthy way of working with that, of owning your emotions. And we're setting that, you know, not ignoring that, not denying that. But we're stepping from a dharmic lens to seeing how does that form around that sense of me. And then from time to time, see if an emotion can be felt without self-referencing. You see, you may need to have a certain calmness, a certain quietness. Maybe it could be in the moment of an intense emotion. Just letting that be felt without having to make a story around you, not just self-reference, but just see if the emotion can just be something that's just flowing through you like a breeze or like a wind. So practice reflection, emotions, and investigation. As you go through your day, bring special awareness to your emotions. Reframe the normal process around the emotion as selfing, establishing and maintaining a sense of self. So just unpack that. Don't try to fix it, try to change it. Just allow it to be there. Just observe it. That's your only task, is just to observe that process of selfing in relationship to emotion. It's subtle. It's like a felt sense of just like, oh, here I am. And from time to time, see if an emotion can be felt without self-referencing. See if you can allow that emotion to flow through you like a wind or a breeze. All right, so that is the homework for this week. And I'll look forward next week to exploring it more with you and seeing how that's landed. All right, so do we have any questions or comments, any sharing you'd like to do? You're welcome to unmute yourself or raise your virtual hand. Okay, Dane, go ahead.
Hey, Tim. You mentioned how much freedom do we actually want at one point. And I know that's something that in like normal times is easy to be like, yeah, I want as much freedom as possible. But then sometimes when you're up against it, it doesn't seem that way. Like you might not, like sometimes for me, it's just, maybe I don't actually want that full freedom for diving into something. And I'm wondering how to investigate that part of it a little more, maybe.
Sure. Yeah. And emotions are a great place for that practice. So have you ever been in an argument with somebody, like someone that's close to you, and you know that you're right and being right is more important than being happy?
Yeah.
You know, so right there, that's an expression of that righteousness, that investment in our view and our opinion. And, you know, we know, of course, that we're right and the person's wrong. And we just need to get, we'll be happy if they saw that, but you know, that's not how it works, especially in a relationship. But that investment, that contraction around that, that opinion, that belief, okay, the release of that, and you say, okay, if I release all opinions, you know, and I've released my positionality, that's the question, like how much do we want that freedom? Because the absolute, you know, it's this, when we talk about absolute reality, it gets a little confusing, because from an absolute reality perspective, it doesn't matter what someone's, any thoughts equally valid and also equally invalid. You know, it doesn't matter what is there. It's held by something that's much vaster than any thought or concept, even actions. And in the course, we say, what about actions of harm and all that? And that's, you know, that's where that edge comes in. So that's why our practice, we have to balance with our ethics and with our sense of integrity. And at the same time, from the absolute perspective, we start to see that, okay, all actions have that equalness. There's a perfection in all of them. Of course, if that's kind of acted upon without the wisdom, then it can cause a lot of harm. So I think that's why some, you know, like Zen tradition sometimes has some strong statements, like if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha. You know, they're saying like, if there's something outside of yourself, that's a sense of separation. And maybe that statement saying the Buddha is found inside you, there's no separation. But that's part of that it's a sharp edge that sometimes is used to kind of break through the relative, you know, fixation. But of course, the practice, absolute and relative, come back together. So the relative is held by the absolute, and it's held with a tremendous amount of care. So I don't know if I quite got to your question there.
Yeah, that example was helpful. But what about maybe when something's not going on, a way to investigate? Like in the moment, something like that makes a lot of sense. But what about when there's not an external circumstance? Would there be a different way of investigating then?
Yes and no. I mean, it's kind of the same kind of all roads lead to Rome kind of a thing. But depending if you're from the north or the south, it has a different, very different direction. So let's see if this helps with that question. So like right now I'm sitting here and I can see my backyard and I see this rhododendron just outside the back. So I can stay here with a sense of, okay, I'm enjoying that. It's beautiful. I like the green. Or I could simply drop that sense of separation, the sense of isolation. As I do that, there's a little bit of maybe unease or like disquiet, like, oh, if I let that go, then who's actually watching this? Who's actually observing this? Who's experiencing this? And there's also this deep sense of stillness and lack of separation that arises with that. So that's that edge of something much more soft and benign. But still, you can see how the roads lead to Rome. There's still that sense of, you know, I like beauty, but I'd like to be that I'm the one who's observing it. Versus, am I willing to completely surrender so there's just beauty? There's not Tim experiencing, there's not Dane experiencing it. They're just the beauty that's there. Even as we're talking right now, you know, you can see that sense of, you know, there's this, okay, that's, he's there and I'm here. We can also let that separation drop. And sometimes that, you know, it's like, okay, I'd rather kind of keep my separation. That feels more comfortable. Does that help more?
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's tricky stuff to talk about, but we'll keep exploring that. Okay, so I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name. It's Sheila? Yeah, Sheila, right. We talked before.
Okay. Yes, it is, Sheila. Thank you. My question is, as somebody who experiences sort of a low-grade, you know, dysthymia, like, you know, low moods, right? It's sort of like it's not classified as depression per se, but it certainly is a preponderance of low moods.
Okay.
You know? So, you know, what you're talking about... you know, when I'm thinking about what you're saying, I'm going, oh, sometimes it takes so long for me even to catch, you know, because it's a chronic sort of state. Mm. Have you any thoughts on this?
So what I hear you describing is that this is such a kind of a pervasive kind of cloud going over it. It's kind of hard to, because it's all there. It's there all the time. It's hard to see in highlighted form.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Well, it's, there's two things that come to mind. You know, one is just the kind of pervasiveness of it. Is you can step back and say, okay, what is that actually, what's the shape of that? What does that feel like? How does it actually shape the way I see the world? You know, I may not be having a direct corollary to my own experience, but sometimes I'm just kind of in a blue mood. You know, I'm just kind of, you know, just not very happy. And I just find that everything kind of gets colored and shaped and filtered through that unhappiness, that sense of dullness, like there's just no life. There's nothing, you know, nothing that's really seems meaningful. You know, there's that quality. Now, if I step back and say, okay, what's the filter that's here? What is that? You know, what does that actually feel like? So then there's a little, even if it's just a little bit of an inch or so of perspective, that this is this experience that I'm having right now, you know, the way that's kind of the universal way. Then it starts to, you start to have your head up a little bit above the water, if that makes sense. Right? So then you say, okay, how is that creating that, you know, how does that change the way I relate to myself and others? You know, that sense of kind of heaviness or blueness or that lower mood. How does that change how I relate to something that's beautiful, something that's sad? You know, how does it change it? Does it dull it? Does it alter it? Am I making any sense at all?
Yes, I think so. Think so. Yeah. It's because, you know, I certainly, it's something I work with, trying to be aware of, and I'm aware of the story. You know,
yes.
That part really is the story. And that's what I think that I'm really trying to work with, of letting go the story. Yeah, but I'm not sure I understood, you know, the formlessness piece in this.
Yes. Yeah. That was kind of a out there part of the talk, that, and that's something that sometimes we can access that through meditation retreats or just deep practice. Sometimes just life events. Like if you've ever been with like a newborn baby and you just are speechless because it's so wonderful. Okay. That's like the experience is too big to hold, but you're still very present for it. That's a glimpse into the formless there and that wonder of that.
Yeah.
The other thought that comes to mind is sometimes we have a default or a bias of our emotional lives. And so you might notice, okay, I tend to feel, these are my go-to emotions. What other emotions don't I usually feel? Like, for example, maybe anger. And start to, you know, pay more attention to, where am I a little irritated? And you can start to see that dullness and that irritation are start to be related, that I feel much more comfortable being kind of blue and sad than feeling my irritation and anger. So you start to say, I want to kind of recover that expression of anger, you know, let myself feel that a little bit more. Sometimes that brings more energy. I mean, one therapist I work with talked about depression being unfelt anger. Yeah. So I'll leave it at that. And just as a way to kind of explore and see, is there a bias, one emotion that I kind of rely on, and see what other emotions are there. You know, you got four core ones of anger, sadness, of happiness, and fear. Which of those are the most common in my life? And maybe the other ones might be worth noticing a little bit more.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. Good to see you again. All right. I see that Shauna and Bruce have their hands up.
Yes. Hi. Sean
Hello.
Here.
Hi, Sean.
Hi. Well, I wasn't going to put my hand up, but I decided just go for it.
Good for you.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to try and understand what I'm going through based on what you were talking about in your talk. I'm experiencing a lot of grief today. I found out this morning that I correspond with prisoners through the San Francisco Zen Center. And my one prisoner, Michael, I hadn't heard from for several months, which was unusual. And we tried to locate him, the coordinator there. And today he emailed me and said he got my last letter that I wrote to Michael. It was returned because he's deceased. Mm. And I just feel very sad and in a state of shock and confused about my state of shock. Michael was 60 years old and incarcerated for 22 years. He incarcerated for life. He wasn't ill the last letter I got from him. I have no way of knowing what happened. Mm. Just a returned letter that says deceased.
Mm.
So there's a lot going on, and I just noticed that I have felt, and I still feel very ungrounded yes. through the day. Waves of sadness, the mind wanting to make sense of it. Now, oh, if I only knew what happened, then maybe I wouldn't feel so distraught. Sadness for the loss of his life. He was an incredible human being. I don't care if he was in jail or not, or what he did in the past. He did so much in his life these last 22 years to improve himself. And he was writing because he is interested in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what our letters were about, talking about the practice and both of our lives. And now he's gone. And I'm going to miss him. I mean, I got as much out of the relationship, maybe more than he did. So my day has been very strange. I feel lightheaded, almost like my body is decomposing. I feel like my body is decomposing. It's very not solid. I don't know if I'm selfing. I don't know if that these are just big waves of feelings going through me. I really don't know. I can't put it in context of what you were talking about in your talk. And I want to. I want to understand it and be with it the best way I can with my practice.
Yes, I appreciate you sharing so intimately about this experience and the courage it took to do that. So first of all that you described seems completely appropriate. It seems completely normal and healthy, and also you're very observant of what your experience is. So if we set aside any idea of how we should be with, we hear that kind of news and we just experience how it is, you just gave a great lesson on how do you observe that sense of being, groundless, not quite sure where you are, and feeling the mind create the story and trying to find some solidity to it. You're observing that process. And of course, it's very disorienting. The grief has that quality to it. And, going back to 2 weeks ago, those talks of finding that sense of ground, but even sharing it like you just did, you may find that there's a little more spaciousness around it. Because you took something that, you probably talked to Bruce about it, but you just shared it with this whole sangha. And now there's a sense of, okay, we're all holding it with you. So it's not such a narrow focus. But it sounds like you're working with it beautifully. You're observing that, let yourself be. It's like, oh yeah, there's someone that you cared about and that you corresponded with. And then suddenly they're dead. And you have no explanation of what happened. Of course, your mind is is confused. Of course, there's sorrow and grief. And right, when I hear you talking about it, it seems like it's really flowing through you. You know, and yes, the mind wants to make a story around it. That's part of that selfing that I talked about. Mm. Don't negate that. Don't say, get rid of it. That's part of that is healthy. The mind's trying to say, well, this death has a way of just kind of taking everything we assume to be that you're going to get, you know, letter after letter from Michael, and suddenly that's ended. Something you counted on, like Naomi, her first line, you counted and carefully saved, you feel it, the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. That's that getting that letter returned, deceased. Right. So yeah, there's this disorientation, and the mind wants to find us a solid place in that. And that's natural. Just notice that. And also notice, let the grief be spread out, you know, through the landscape, through the land, through all the other prisoners, you know, all the people who are suffering, all the people who are not suffering. And by doing that, you know, the way you're observing it, you're relating to it from a place of, you're seeing the non-self is starting to come through with that. These kind of intense things naturally can lead us into that sense of non-self. You're just like, okay, the unknown, the grief, it's such a big thing. And you release the contraction around it. And then you contract back and make a story, and that's okay. And you release and you contract. So it's like this inhale and exhale.
It's like breathing.
It is like breathing. Mm. Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you for connecting with people who are so often forgotten in our society and you know, grieving for his loss.
He was a beautiful human being. He was so creative. He wrote poetry. I mean, he wrote poetry that was so out there, I didn't even understand half of it, but I just knew it was beautiful. Mm. You know, it was so beautiful. And he told me the story of his life, of what happened to him when he was born and how he lived. And he was in the foster system. And I mean, he didn't have a chance, really, but he made the most of his life. And I'm going to miss him. I'm just going to miss him.
Yes, of course, yes. You know, and you're going through grief work. You know, the grief is arising. And I remember Rodney would often say that grief work is memory work. So you may be going through some of the old letters, you know, bit by bit, and just reflecting on that connection. Giving yourself time, you know, allow yourself to be human.
Yeah.
She may be the only person grieving for him.
Yeah, I may be the only person grieving for him. Mm-hmm. That's part of it, I think, that just really hits me is that, I mean, he has family, but, you know, he's been in jail for 22 years. Not many calls, not close. I might be the only one who cares. I don't know. But I care.
Yes, and that's tremendous to have one person who cares very fully.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. I understand. I get it now what I'm going through in relationship to the talk. I just need to just be with it like the breath.
Yes.
Sometimes it goes out. And sometimes it comes in.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for sharing that. Nice to see you both.
Yeah.
All right. I know it's very moving. Let's see if there's anyone else who'd like to share anything.
Tim, I can't figure out how to raise my hand. But
okay, you go ahead, Emery. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, too. So thinking about emotions and when I feel my strongest emotions, it's usually in interactions with my kids. Mm-hmm. it's with parenting. Particularly if one of my kids is struggling and I feel worried or I feel angry at the way they've behaved or a decision they've made or overwhelmed, like not knowing what to do. And at times like that, like I totally get what you're talking about with just like, just kind of letting the emotion be experiential and flow and not pinning it down with words or ideas. Hmm. But as a parent, I feel a lot of responsibility to use the feelings that I'm feeling as a clue that something is wrong and that my kid needs help or support or something. And so I definitely jump into problem solving mode. And so, you know, in this situation, I don't know if it makes sense to, I don't really know what to do because I feel like I do need to take some action a lot of the time. And going into mode number one of just sort of feeling and experiencing and not selfing doesn't seem very responsible. It's like I am a self and I'm a mom and my kid is really having an obstacle. So
yeah. Yes, I can relate to that, that process, having a 17-year-old and like the choices, you know, she makes or doesn't make, it's like, yeah, it's a very alive process, isn't it? And so kind of looking at the talk, you know, that narrow focus, there's a part of letting the emotions flow. This is much more that first part. Okay. There's this, the selfing mechanism. So just try, you know, just try to understand that. You know, so like, let's say your child does, you know, X and you want to say Y. You also notice, okay, how you have that, how that self is forming around that. Okay, we're not trying to get rid of the self. We're not trying to judge the self. We're just trying to understand it. To practice the Dharma is to study the self. Okay, so start with that part. Okay, so how does this sense of me show up around that? So I'll give you so an example just from with my relationship with my daughter. There's so many of them. I just put one out. Yeah, so she had, I don't think she's listening. She doesn't listen to these talks. But the she had an you know, because of COVID, there was a math book she didn't turn in from last year. So it was like a $95 fine. And so it's like, there's the last, you know, day in person for that math class to turn that book in. So, you know, I sent her a text, said, did you turn the book in? And, you know, it was all the problem solving. So that part, yeah, we need to get the fine off her record. But there's also the part of me that, okay, well, I don't quite trust her to follow through. I'm not sure, you know, she's going to remember, you know, she got up late and, you know, she stayed up too late and she's on her phone too much. There's all that stuff. But that's, if I step back from the details, so again, we'll take care of the details, but stepping back and noticing, well, I'm getting really contracted. I want her to be a certain way. That's that mechanism of selfing around it, right? And so no matter what you may actually do and interact with your child, notice that sense of selfing around it. And as a parent, it's often going to be around control, and it's going to feel really justified because, of course, you know, you're much older, you're much wiser, you know, there's all these justifications that you have. But there's also that control. There's that, you know, not wanting them to get hurt. There's all these things that come up. That's what I mean by studying the self. So what I would recommend is just, let's say you have the impulse. Next time you have an impulse to do an intervention, just set a timer for 5 minutes and just sit with it. Okay. Not saying that you're not going to do the intervention or do it, but just to say, what does it feel like to want to do the intervention? You know, what's the mind stream, the justification around it, the story making? that's coming up around that, and notice, you know, and play with, okay, if I don't do anything, that often really highlights that story even more. Like, oh no, then, you know, they won't get into the college of, you know, they're ruining their GPA, you know, whatever comes up, just to feel it. And then, like last, this is also similar to last talks, you know, feel the most tender aspect of that. Because, you know, as a parent, you know, we have to learn that we are not our children, you know, that our children have their own people, they're their own beings. And it's confusing, I think, especially for mothers, because the baby literally grows within you and then it comes out of you. And there's so much intimacy, so much closeness, so much lack of separation. And then that starts to have to come out. And then it's like, you know, sometimes the kid wants to come back and you want to go back. And sometimes it's, you know, that's the play of it. That's the richness of that. But the best thing I can suggest is just to pause before you act, before you speak, and just feel that. Let that be unpacked, and frame it as, how am I selfing myself? If you judge the fact that you're selfing, you've just created another selfing mechanism, right? It says, okay, how am I selfing myself? Oh, that's, you know, okay, yeah. And then sometimes by doing that, you might realize, okay, how can I maybe approach in a different way? Like, I use my wife a lot for this, because I might say, okay, I hate that she's doing this. And she might suggest a very different way, or reflect how I tend to approach and how my daughter reacts around that. So you can start to say, okay, maybe there's a different way. And maybe starting by asking a question, like, you know, do you need some help around this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a very rich part of practice. It's not easy, but because it's not easy, it actually has a lot of depth, a lot of potential insight.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's very helpful. I think, that will be a 5 minutes of a lot of learning. Yeah.
That's right. And I bet those things that you're learning, if you ask your child, they may say, yeah, you know, when you say that, I feel controlled. You know, they probably know, they can probably pretty accurately describe what's going on internally with you.
Yeah. 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 Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. Thank you. Nice to see you from Portland there.
Yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, Zoom allows this lack of geographic boundaries. So thank you for sharing and asking that. I think that's it. So let's just end with just a minute of silence, you know, offering metta to this man named Michael. Sense of offering him well wishing wherever he might be, whatever leads to his life after death, caring that he has passed, caring that he used his life well, may he be safe and protected. May he be peaceful. May there be ease.